Continuing in mitzvah Shin Chaf Dalet 324, which is the mitzvah to take the lulav and the esrog and the hadasim and the aravos, the four species, on Sukkah. So now we're going to sink our teeth into a little bit of the halachos of what constitutes a correct type of species and which constitutes an incorrect type of species, and what types of blemishes these different species might have that would render them invalid for use on the Sukkot holiday. So we're at the paragraph, Notlin lulav echad. Got that? Notlin lulav echad. Yeah. The notlin lulav echad ve'esrog echad. One lulav and one esrog. How do we know that it's one lulav? It says in the pasuk, kapos tamarim, palm fronds. So what does it mean, palm fronds? It means that each person should take more than one palm frond. But it says that since the traditional orthography of the word kapos is in defective spelling, what we call, that means it lacks a vav. It just is kaf, pei, tuf. So it looks like it says kapas in the singular. So therefore, we learn from that that the kapos tamarim, when it's, even though the we read the verse kapos tamarim, it's referring to all of you take many lulavim, but each person only takes one lulavim. One esrog said pri eitz hadar, the fruit of a hadar tree, ushnei badei arava, and you should take two aravos. Why? Because it says arvei nachal, willows of the brook or the wadi. So since it uses the plural, and the minimum thing that would be appropriate to use the plural for is two.
But isn't arvos the plural of
that? Aravos. Yeah, okay. These things go back and forth in biblical Hebrew. Mm-hmm. They don't always, there's not always 100% consistency. Yeah. So that means you have to use two. And then it says, anaf eitz avos, as we'll see in a minute. So that's why you have to take shlosha badei hadas kosher. That you have to take three hadasim which are kosher. So let's analyze this for a minute. There are a few things that require attention. One is that there's such thing as a hadas, which is not kosher, which is that the leaves are not threefold per, you know, all the way up the stem. You need, as the Sefer Chaim is going to say in a second, you need three leaves together. That would be an example of a hadas that's not kosher. So why does he tell you you need three hadasim that are kosher? Obviously, they're kosher.
What do you mean?
Obviously, if you need three, they all have to be kosher, right? If the hadas is not kosher, it's not kosher. You shouldn't be putting in the lulav, right? The reason he's telling you hadas kosher is that you need three hadasim sherim, is that according to many shitas, and it sounds like here from the Sefer Chinuch also, you're allowed to add extra hadasim, and those hadasim could even be non-kosher hadasim. That the more hadasim you put in the lulav, as long as you have three kosher ones, really? The more hadasim you put in the lulav, the nicer it might be. So I think some Taimanim still do this, Yemenites, that they have these huge fat lulavim. You've seen this, I'm sure?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have these huge fat lulavim.
And they're like a tree. I mean, it's...
they have the lulav and the aravos, and this huge bundle of hadasim, at least three of which are kosher. Some say maybe just if... But again, the prevailing minag is recorded in the Shulchan Aruch, which is Alpi Kabbalah, is that one should stick to the number of prescribed species, and one should not add thereto.
If you have Lecha Mishneh and you have three, is that pretty much the same idea? In other words, all you need is two, but if there's three, there's definitely two.
Huh. Yeah, that's a good question. The Gemara says in Brachos that there were two Amoraim who used to do Lecha Mishnah in different ways. So the first rabbi used to take two, he used to hold two challahs, but he would just cut one, which is the normal minhag that most people have. And it says that the other Amora used to, this is again, I'm going right now according to the opinion of the Rashba followed by the Vilna Gaon, that this, the second Amora, used to cut all the challahs. So what does it mean, all the challahs? It means that even though you just need two, so he used to cut normally lechem mishnah, he'd be holding the two challahs during hamotzi, and he would bedavka cut both challahs, because there's not that you're not yotze lechem mishnah. Lechem mishnah, you're yotze as long as you hold the two when you're making hamotzi. It's not that you need
them.
Yeah. It's not that, I mean, bedavid you'd be yotze if they're on the table, but lechatchila you're supposed to hold them. So he held that there's a special din on Shabbos to show that we're giving everyone as much food as they want, so much food, you know, we're gonna be very generous with the portions that we give, that we should cut all the bread that's on the table for Shabbos. So that's why, even though it's not mentioned explicitly in the Gemara, the Vilna Gaon, it said one time, it said he preferred that there would be only two challahs on the table, so that he would just have the Lecha Mishnah, he would have the exact number two. He said one time, someone before Hamotzi put in front of him a whole basket of rolls. So when he made Hamotzi, he cut all the rolls on the table because of this din that is not just limited to the two of Lecha Mishnah, even though, but yeah, Lechatchila, we tried, we just have two.
Did you say din?
Din of Lecha Mishnah, yeah. So Lechatchila, yeah, we try to just have two because we want to focus on the Lecha Mishnah. The point is that there was a double portion, not 14 portions.
Yeah.
But according to us, that we don't cut all the challahs on the table necessarily, so there's no problem. Even if there are 70 challahs on the table, so when you want to make hamotzi, so you take two challahs, and then you cut one or two of them, whatever, and then you don't worry about the rest of the ones on the table. But if you have this minhag that you cut all of them, then you have more of a problem.
So I'm not talking about on the table, I'm talking about under the challah decal.
No, it's simple. So, if you hold the two during the bracha, then that's good. It's the same shaila, by the way, about the Shabbos candles. They're supposed to be, the reason that the standard minhag is to light two Shabbos candles is that there's one Zachor and one for Shomer, the two languages that are used in the Ten Commandments. That's why, and everything in Shabbos is two. That's what the Kolbo says. That's why you're supposed to have two Shabbos candles. Everything is two. There's Lecha Mishnah, there's Shnei Kivasim, Yom HaShabbos, Shnei Kivasim. There were two lambs that were offered as the Korban Musaf. So two is a common theme for Shabbos, so you should have two candles. So then some people, based on this, question the minhag that some people have to light many candles in honor of Shabbos, either because they're a number of children or a number of people in the household, or Stam, that they some people light 26 candles because that's Shem Hashem.
Fire has
26 candles. So there are different reasons for lighting more candles, but some people question that based on the idea that if you light more than two candles, you lose this allusion to the davka. Most people hold, no, it means at least two. If you have the two, so... And that's why some people have the minhag also, that even if they light many candles, they have two distinctive candles. So they'll have, two candles with the nice silver candlesticks, and then, little tea lights surrounding it for the number of candles that they have. Or they'll have a candelabrum, actually, where they have, it's arranged in such a way that there are two central candles, and then they're completely distinctive. There's some who do that, but that's not the norm of practice, that people light more, and they consider that not to be a problem. Yeah.
Question about this business with the house. A lot of when there's not that many people around the table, and they know they don't really need, they don't need two big challahs, so they use a standard challah, and they use a little challah roll, because they don't want to, they don't want to cut up two, I don't know why. But what's the deal on
Which one are you cutting, the big one or the small one?
They cut the big one.
That's fine.
And they put away the small one.
There's no,
it's not disrespecting the challahs to make it a small one. Okay.
No.
Never knows.
I would say, though, that if you have, let's say, just one or two people at a Shabbos meal and you just want to use a roll, then it's more correct to use two rolls as opposed to using just the big challah as the lecha mishnah, not cutting the big challah. Because there's always a din by hamotzi that when you have a few different options of which bread to cut at any meal, not just the Shabbos meal, you're supposed to go with a nicer bread in honor of the bracha of hamotzi.
But if it's just like the two of you...
So it's better to use two rolls.
Instead of the big, glorious
one. Right.
Why is that?
Because if you use the big glorious looking one, then you're supposed to cut the big glorious looking one.
We would cut the big.
Oh, so you could, but I'm saying if you don't want to cut the big one, if you want to cut the small one, then it's better to use two small ones.
If you want to.
But if you use a big one and a small one, you want to cut the big one, then that's fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's no problem.
I didn't lose sleep over this, but
yeah.
No, we would cut the. Actually, I think we ended up using two rolls, but this one.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody eats bread anymore. Okay.
Oh, I do.
No, a lot of people do still eat bread, but it's less common than it used to be, you know, 1,000 years ago. Okay, so he says, so fine. So that's the normal practice, is that we limit ourselves to the standard minimum regular number of the minim, which is one lulav, one esrog, three hadasim, and two aravos. However, there is another opinion in the Tanoim. It's about machlokes brought in the Mishnah that Rebbe Akiva, there's a machlokes between Rebbe Shmuel and Rebbe Akiva, I believe. So we pass like Rebbe Shmuel. So Rebbe Akiva holds one of each. One lulav, one hadas, one arava, one esrog. So that's why in certain emergency situations, like in towns in Europe where they did not have access to the proper number of the four species, so they sometimes relied on the opinion of Rebbe Akiva, which is that, which some Rishonim Paskin like that make Gradin, and they did just one of each. Okay, if you're in such an emergency situation, so there's what to talk about. But again, that's basically unheard of nowadays that we have this standard number, one, three, and two. And you arrange them in such a way that the aravos, you turn the back of the lulav towards you. There's something in the lulav that's called the spine, the shidra. Shidra means spine. So you turn the spine of the lulav towards you. You put the hadasim on the right side, and you put the aravos on the left side. And then you tie them together, you put them in the koshikol, whatever. That's how it works. Either way, you should do it lechatchila the way I just described. And also, no, I'm sorry, of course, no, there are different, there's another minhag al pi Arizal where it has...
How do you remember?
You have to have a legal-oriented mind.
You look it up on
the... So you have, according to the Arizal, I'm sorry, no, the Yoriyot Tzibidiyavit, if you have it in a different way, according to the Arizal, I think Chabad does this, that the way you do it is, you have the lulav in the middle, then one arava on each side, then one hadas on each side of the arava, then another hadas on top.
That's
on top of the lulav.
That's very interesting.
What? No. On top of the spine of the lulav. Like you lie it on top of the spine. That's the minag of the Arizal. Yeah. So also there's a halacha that people should keep in mind. You see oftentimes that this is not observed correctly, which is that the hadasim are supposed to be higher up in the bundle than the aravos. That, in other words, they don't have to be physically longer, but just in the way you tie them in the bundle, the aravos are supposed to be, the hadasim are supposed to be higher up on the, you know, the tops are supposed to get higher up on the spine of the lulav than the aravos. So it's fine if you put the aravos down and you have some of the arava protruding below the lulav. You might want to cut that off if there's enough shear there, but that's fine. I think it's brought in the name of Rashi that you're not Yotze if the aravos are higher than the hadasim. Why this would be the case, nobody can really figure out, but nevertheless, should be careful on this matter as well. Yeah?
I see a question. Okay, you said, was it the Arizal with the different...
Yeah.
Where the Chabad gets it from. So, he's pretty late in the game. Like, how did he come up with this, and how did it get accepted? They've been doing it for...
Well, everybody... This happens all the time. You know, rabbis... Everybody has a chelik in Torah. That's why the Torah works. That every generation, as long as you work within the system, rabbis are... have a certain chidushim. That they feel that they're restoring the old way that got corrupted, or they have a new understanding of the Kabbalah, or they...
Okay.
You know, again, we're not talking about him saying that, you know, lobster is now permitted.
No.
Talking about a different arrangement in the lulav. It's not such a big deal, so to speak. But this is a problem also. The tying the hadasim higher than the aravos is the reason people don't get it right a lot of the time, is because naturally the aravos are usually longer than the hadasim.
Right.
So you have to make sure to move them down or cut them a little bit.
Yeah.
To on the bottom. Not
on
the top.
Bottom.
Not the top.
Got that.
So that's why this is often a problem. But that's what one should keep in mind. Okay, so what are kosher hadasim? Says this is Mrs. Hirsch's question from last time. We are now going to answer it at long last. Kilomar sheyehu olav asuyin tlosa bekina. So what is, it says in the Torah, anaf eitz avos, the bough of a leafy, lush, plaited, whatever you want, a tree. So in other words, if you have a branch, and you want it to be lush and surrounded by leaves, so there have to be at least three leaves.
Ah.
Right? Let's say this pen. Can I use your pen as an example? So you have this pen, and you have, let me use my finger as leaves. So you have two leaves, a leaf here and a leaf here. Mm. So you're going to have a bare spot on the stem. So you have to have another leaf there.
Awesome.
So that it should be completely surrounded and covered by leaves. And that's why it says Anaf Eitz Avos. And there's supposed to be three. Again, it's interesting because I think Rashi in one place on the Gemara says three or more. So you get the impression that if you found a hadas with four, five, six, seven leaves somehow all surrounding the stem, that would be better. That would be more mehudr than one with just three leaves, but normally we just accept one with three leaves. It's considered weird if you have more than three. But it has to be completely surrounded by the leaves, three per, how do you say this in English?
Twig.
No.
Each level.
On each level, there have to be three.
Okay.
So what does it mean there are three on each level? There's also something that the Gemara describes, which is called a hadas shota, which people think means a stupid myrtle. But it doesn't mean a stupid myrtle. It means a myrtle that's like a twig. A shotim are like used as whips. You know, it means like a twig as opposed to a proper hadas, a hadas mishulash, which the Gemara says is that there are two leaves, and then one leaf, again, there are three, but they're not on the same level. Their leaves are not on the same level. So the leaves also have to nicely surround the stem at the same level. So you should have a group of three leaves at the same level surrounding the stem. And it's also a hitter. It's better if the leaves are smallish. That's also better. But that the levels are close enough together that the leaves of one level reach the leaves of the next level so that the whole branch is nicely lush and covered with...
How far down from the top?
So it's going to tell you it has to be a three tvachim, three handbreadths, which is about, again, lechumra, it's about 30 centimeters.
Oh, my.
I don't know what that is. An inch is...
You've got to check each level to see that it satisfies that requirement?
So the minimum is that within the three tvachim, the majority has to be... three on each level. Yeah, but that's what people do. People who are scrupulous about their hadasim, you know, sort through different hadasim, and they check each level to make sure that it's properly threefold. So, what constitutes threefold? How do you define what's threefold mishulash on one level? How do you determine that? So what you think it means is, you look at the leaves. If the leaves, you know, surround them, they look like they're about, the leaves are on the same level. So that's mishulash, that's good. That's mishulash. However, Rashi says, amazing chiddush regarding what's considered mishulash. He says mishulash means that the three leaves stem from the same point in the branch.
I don't think that ever happens. I've never seen it.
Well, you're not a brisker. Okay. If you were a brisker, you would sort through 500 hadasim until you find three that suit your that suit this opinion of Rashi. So that's that means according to this Rashi, you have to look through each of the stem. You know, they go through the whole stem of the hadas. And find that the leaves not only look like they're on the same level, you know, in terms of covering the branch, but you have to look at the point where the leaves on each level are connected to the branch, and all three have to look like they're mamish converging at the same point.
And you have to do
inside
this for
the stem.
All three of your.
Yeah.
It's interesting he would say that because he was a vintner. He worked with vines and plants.
Yeah.
So he must have had some expertise in.
Well, you can find such things. You know, look at, like I said, go to briskers in Israel. That's what they do. They want hadasim that are that look like this.
They have to start getting ready for it.
I mean, it's very rare. These hadasim are very rare. They're very, very rare.
What? Is Israeli accepted as a posek?
Yeah, sure.
Yes. But nobody,
yeah.
I mean, regular people, let's face it, don't do that, right?
Right, so that's not the normative opinion. Many opinions hold that it does just go by the leaves. It has nothing to do with where the stem comes out of the branch. But then there is a that many hold that it do have does have to do with what the, how the leaves come out of the branch, but are not as machmer as Rashi.
Is this about basic acceptability or about a hiddur mitzvah?
Basic acceptability.
I'm glad.
So many.
Shalo Asani Brisker.
So many the Chazon Ish had a more lenient standard, even if you want to go by the stems, that the stems coming out from the same level, he says, it doesn't have to be, we don't go mamish, like the simple understanding of this Rashi, that it has to come out from this, you know, one point inside the stem, the mamish from the same point. It should be that if you would draw, if you would take a, like a measuring tape or a string, something like that, and wrap it around the bottoms of the stems, that it would form a circle.
What else would it form?
In other words, like this. Can I borrow your phone for a second? So I can add a piece of paper. This is very convenient. Thank you.
You'll put it on the back and then I'll come
back. Oh, good. Okay. So here's your. I'm enlarging it for. Here's your hadas. And you have a leaf here. And the leaf here, and the leaf here. So they're all sort of at the same level.
But they're not surrounded. It's all coming out from the same.
No, so
they're
here.
Not surrounding.
No, here. They're not on the same level. But no, here, if you would take a, if you would draw, you could draw a line through the beginnings of the stems. The way the places where the stems are attached to the.
Yeah.
Right. Right. You could draw a line like that or a circle. Whereas Rashi would hold that it would literally have to be like this. Here, again, that's a little bit exaggerated. But according to some shitas, if there's a leaf here, and a leaf here, and a leaf here, then it's still meshulash because all the leaves are at about the same level and cover the same area of the branch. As
they
opposed
all
to
come out from the same.
No, no, no.
Point.
This is Rashi. This is the Chazon Ish, and this is
the
leaf.
Really see the What's the difference between this one and this one?
This one is that the leaves start at slightly different levels, but they're sort of, you know, adjacent to each other, okay, to the extent that you could draw a line around the bottoms of the stems, the place of attachment to the branch. Whereas Rashi is. Not that you can just draw a line at whatever angle, but they have to.
But if they come out of the same point, then they're not surrounding the stem.
No, they do. What do you mean? No. Not that they grow out of the same place in the stem. Inside the stem, they're mamish at the same level, so that the roots of each leaf look like they could mamish intersect inside. Yeah. You know, one's here. You know, one's here. They're like. You know, inside the stem, this would be the cross section of the stem. That's according to Rashi. That would be mamish starting at the same point inside the stem. Okay, so if you can find ones that mamish start inside the stem, you know, more power to you. So that's why a lot of people don't rely on the prepackaged hadasim because they want to look for themselves. In Israel, you don't find this so much in America, although I assume it's occasionally in America as well, that in Israel, you have a lot of times Arabs, because they know they can make a lot of money off this, that they bring a huge loose thing of hadasim. They weren't graded by any rabbis or anyone looking through it, you know, prepackaged three kosher ones together in a package. Just whatever they grabbed off the tree, a huge bundle of hadasim, and you pay 100 shekels, whatever you pay for the, maybe more. No, this was last time I saw this, was a long time ago. So then you pay for the privilege to be able to look through this bundle that they have, okay, this huge vat of hadassim. And sometimes you find much better ones than are in the prepackaged, but sometimes you lose. It's a gamble. Okay. But that's sometimes you have people who sell pre-sorted hadassim that are supposed to be close at or close to the Brisker standard. So people, to save themselves time and energy, and they want to super moder hadassim, then they go there. To such places. But you have to beware. I say this, the very important public service announcement, that you really have to beware of the prepackaged hadasim.
Oh.
These are not under recognized hechsherim. So people look at the at the package and they say, oh, Hebrew writing, but that's whatever. You know, it must be, that, you know, these rabbis know much more than I do. I'm just taking these hadasim and I'm not going to give it another thought. But it's actually, this is not one of these things where you hear that, you know, there was a restaurant under Hashgacha and, you know, people are whispering about it, that there were problems with Hashgacha, you know, and you never know what's really true or they're just, you know, some political thing about the Hashgacha. You can buy one of these packages and see with your own eyes that the Hashgacha is not good. It's a good lesson also that, you know, sometimes you go to a city that you're not familiar with and you want to go eat in a restaurant. So you look in the window and there's a tuda's kashrus. You don't know how reliable the extra is. What could it be? I see people with yarmulkes. There's Hebrew writing here. You know, the Rav HaMachshir is titled here as Harav Hagon HaTzadik, you know, so and so. They must be more religious than I am. Who am I to say that it's not good? Even though it's not a recognized hechsher, of course, I'm going to eat here. So use the hadasim as a musar haskel, as a warning that when something has a hechsher, again, just does not mean that it's good. It has to be a recognized, reliable, trusted hechsher, because you can see with your own eyes that in many, I've seen it many times, that you can have a package of hadasim that states mahadrin, kosher, whatever, you open it up and it is absolutely not kosher. See with your own eyes, mamish. Really? So you have to be, you cannot rely, I tell everyone, you cannot rely, absolutely not, on the hashgacha, on the hadasim without inspecting them yourself. Sometimes you can see through the package and you can sort of get an idea as to whether they're really mishulashim or not. But sometimes it was out.
If my only place to get these things is that once a year when it used to be the Bnei Akiva people, whoever it is.
So hopefully it's good. Hopefully it's good. I'm not saying it's for sure not good, but I'm saying you can't rely on the hashgacha. You open the package, you have to inspect it yourself. And if it's not good, maybe they'll give you a refund. Maybe you have to buy
another one.
Yeah.
That's a good refund.
So a good idea, actually, is that I do a sort of a variation on this. You could get together a bunch of people, and all together, b'shutvus, as partners, you purchase several packs of hadasim, and you sort through them, and you sort out who gets, if you find, you know, among the pack of, let's say you buy 20 hadasim, and then you have 10 that are good. Well, it's not a multiple of 3, it doesn't help you so much. You have 12 that are good, hopefully. So then you and you have 4 people who went in together to buy this. So then you're okay. You didn't. It's much. Each of you will lose a lot less money than if one person, you know, buys a package of prepackaged asim, opens them up, finds that they're not good, and has to buy a second, and then a third, and then a fourth, until they finally. It's only crazy because you have these corrupt people who package hadasim, which are not kosher, with pseudo hechsher.
That's weird.
And
how do you get away with this?
Because many of them are kosher maker adin. I'm not saying it's for sure not, but I'm just saying you can't rely on it. That's all. And so you can't just blindly rely on the hechsher. That's my whole point. That they get away with it because a lot of people don't know any better.
This is the first I've heard of that.
Yeah, there was a thing. The Chicago Rabbinical Council published a declaration, you know, saying you absolutely cannot rely on the hashgacha, on the hadasim, and people think, fine. So that's the story with the hadasim, and again, everybody should check themselves that they're actually mishulash, that they're actually threefold at each level, at least by the leaves, and preferably even that you should be able to draw a line around it. And again, those who are extra punctilious get ones that are look like they're mamish coming out from the same spot. Okay. V'shir orko shel lulav. How long must the lulav be? L'chol apochos arba tvachim. It has to be 4 tvachim. V'hadas v'arava shlosha tvachim atzevos. That they have to be 3 tvachim. The hadasim and the ravas each have to be 3 tvachim. Shein eser etzbos v'gudol, which are 10 thumb breadths wide. Tvachim atzevos means that the thumb breadths are, it literally means sad. Sad tvachim, sad hand breadths, sad cubits. What's a sad cubit? And a cubit can't be happy or sad. The reason is, the way you measure it is when you're measuring the thumbs, whether the thumbs, you know, are pressed lightly together, that they're happy, they're more relaxed, or they're squished together. or they're squished together, that means they're seds. They're two different measures of an amma, which is that amma made of the sad amma, where the thumbs are squished together, is a little bit less than the happy amma, where the thumbs are lightly touching together. So, l'chumra, again, we consider the shear for the... less is acceptable b'shas etchak, but l'chumra, we consider the shear for the lulav would again be 40 centimeters, talking about, again, the spine of the lulav, not the leaves, not from bottom of the lulav to the top of the leaves, rather it goes to the spine, that has to be 40 centimeters, and the hadasim and the aravos are 30 centimeters, and on the 30 centimeters of the hadas, of the myrtle, most of those groups of leaves have to be mishulash. Again, preferably all, but most. At the very least, most have to be mishulash. And the reason the reason that the lulav is supposed to be longer than the hadasim and the aravos is when you shake it, you know, it shouldn't be all bundled together with the hadasim and aravos. There should be a little bit on the top of the lulav that protrudes beyond. Again, it looks better also with a bundle. It shouldn't be exactly the same level. The lulav is supposed to be a little bit higher and shake. When you shake it, it's supposed to go, the shaking is supposed to be a little bit beyond. The rustling of the leaves has to be beyond that. And again, so if we have a tefach of the spine should extend above the hadasim and the aravos. Veshir esrog ein pachos mikabetza. An esrog, the minimum size is the size of an egg.
With a small egg, a jumbo egg.
Again, you'll never have a problem with this.
Yeah,
there's no problem. There are no esrogim found on the market. They would never make it to America for, you know, certainly, and even in the Israeli market, you're never going to find an esrog less than the size of an egg. So this is not something we have to worry about. What's the biggest shear for an esrog?
Is there a maximum size?
There is no maximum.
Is it tame on
either? Yeah.
Right, there is no maximum size
Hello.
For an esrog.
Mango.
None at all. As long as you can hold it. If you can hold it, it's good.
One hand. Okay.
However,
okay.
It's considered, again, Teimanim have different standards of beauty that they think the biggest esrog possible is just the most desirable thing imaginable. But we, non-Teimanim, generally assume that the most beautiful esrog is a moderately sized esrog that you can hold nicely in your hand and shake with the with a lulav together.
It makes it more beautiful if it has bumps.
Yeah, that's one of the simanim of an esrog that distinguish it from a lemon. The gartel thing is not, it's a chesidisha thing. It's not the.
It's a what?
It's a chesidisha thing. There's no, because they. It's like the esrog is wearing a gartel. There's no.
It might be the only thing I can think. I think they're kind of funny, but I think I had one once, but they are a little easier to hold.
Okay.
Okay.
If you like it, if it looks prettier to you,
it doesn't look like a real.
If it looks prettier to you, you can have one with a gartel. That means it has a waist. It looks like wearing a belt. You know, it's thinner. It's thinner in the middle, like an hourglass figure. So some people like that better. Among Chassidim, they love esrogim wearing a gartel, so to speak. But among our circles, it's not considered to be any advantage whatsoever to have an esrog with gartel.
Good, I'll leave those for the other guys.
V'din hadvarim shalula esrog v'arava bahem. What types of things could render the four species disqualified? So one by one. By an esrog, what?
If the pitum breaks off.
If the pitum breaks off. So...
What did you say? The pitum breaks off?
There are a lot of different...
Hold on.
So there are a lot of different disqualifications. There are some which fall into the category of hadar, that it's insufficiently beautiful. There's some that fall in the category of stolen, for example, which is no good. There's some that fall into the category of it's not considered a complete fruit. Like if the esrog is too immature, it doesn't look like a full esrog. Not the correct species or not the correct look. Again, there are a lot of different psulim that are listed in Chazal, and the Rishonim sort of struggle to categorize each one as to what the correct type is. So we have a principle. So for example, with a psulim of hadar, there's also another psul that just applies on the first day, or the first 2 days, preferably in Chutz Aretz, where the mitzvah is d'oraisa, that there's a problem of chaser, that if the esrog is missing a piece of any size, even if a tiny bit is missing, then the esrog is no good for use on the first day, even if you can barely notice it. But if it's actually missing a piece of the flesh, then it's no good. That's another thing about the first day. And the psulim of hadar, The ones that are because of beauty, which again, the different opinions about which psulim fall under that category, then according to some, that's only pasul the first days. According to some, it's pasul all sukkahs for all 7 days. You have a lot of different shitas, but if we don't, again, we don't necessarily have to even engage with these things nowadays because all our baminim, you know, are generally, we generally try to be machmer since they're so plentiful and available, that we try to be machmer that they should be wonderful all 7 days long. So missing the pitum, that's a shaila as to whether it's a psul of hadar or a psul of chaser. So according to some opinions, it's a psul of chaser, and it would only be a problem the first day. And according to some opinions, it's a psul of hadar, and it might be pasul. Again, the different opinions whether hadar is pasul all 7 days or not. So then that's why we're machmer, that we always say that if the esrog is missing the pitum, then it's out, and you can't use it anymore because we're machmer for the shitas that such a thing is pasul all 7 days long. It's definitely pasul the first day, but it's pasul. We're machmer that it's pasul all 7 days long. So there are different. Some esrogim just naturally don't have pitums. That they fall off in an early stage of development, and the esrog completely grows on the tree without a pitum. There's a little indentation on the top of the esrog where the pitum used to be. So that is okay. And if it grows with the pitum and the pitum falls off, then that's not okay. There is an intermediate category, which is what happens if the pitum falls off in a late stage of development on the tree. So the minhag seems to be that we accept that, that as long as the pitum fell off while it was still on the tree, it was considered to grow without a pitum, and then it's okay if the esrog does not have a pitum. However, that is somewhat questionable, whether that really counts. So either you should try to get an esrog that there's an indentation at the top which indicates that the pitum fell off at a very early stage of the fruit's development, or get one with a pitum. So I generally recommend that if at all possible, also prettier, I think. But generally, it is better, unless you know what you're looking for, to make sure that it fell off at an early stage of development. So it is better to get an esrog with a pitum and you just save it from dropping or from young children getting a hold of it. And that's a story with the pitum. There are other things about the esrog that are in classical literature which are called achazosis, like when it has boils or black dots or things like that. So then that could be a problem, especially if it's on the top part of the esrog where it starts to, you know, go like this. That's considered, you know, where your attention focuses the most. So problems there are often worse. But again, we rarely encounter these types of actual blemishes that would render it pustle. What we do encounter is something called a bletel. Who's heard of the word bletel? A little blot.
Bletel is not a blot.
Bletel in Yiddish is a little blot. That's where it comes from.
A leaf.
Well, leaf.
Yeah.
Tom,
a leaf.
A leaf. Yeah. Of a bush.
It doesn't mean that it's a leaf. It means where the esrog was hit by a leaf on the tree and it created a scab.
Ah.
So when the esrog was on the tree and it was hit by something and it created a scab, so because we generally like the esrog to be completely clean, again, it's these things don't render the esrog pasul, but that's why this is what really raises the price of an esrog, that when it's clean of bletlach, which are any type of, you know, deformed aspect of the esrog or anything, you know, that's different from how an esrog should naturally be. Well, this is natural, I guess. That's why it's not really pasul, but that's why people like to have the esrog. That's why people pay a lot of money to have an esrog clean of anything or any shilas of things on the esrog that potentially shouldn't be there. So especially, again, on the top part of the esrog where it starts to narrow, so then people like to have it as clean as possible of bletlach. So that's why you have these, you know, they're different things that people think make esrogim more beautiful, but if it doesn't have bletlach or very minimal bletlach, so the esrog is going to cost much more money. Okay. People like it to have a nice shape to it, which meaning not lemon-like, but rather it should sort of look like a tower, that it's, you know, and then goes thin on the top. And also one thing, again, it's a lot of this different understandings about how exactly this affects the kashrus of the esrog, but the color. What about the color?
Yellow.
Not
supposed
green.
To be yellow. It's supposed to be yellow.
It's green, it's not ripe yet.
Yeah, some chassidim, because of Zohar apparently, where it describes the esrog as yorok, so they like to take bedavka, green esrog. So first of all, this is incorrect for two reasons. Because one, the halacha says the halacha that the esrog is supposed to be yellow. And B, even in the Zohar, it doesn't mean yorok doesn't mean green. Yorok in Chazal is sort of a catch-all term for colors besides, red and black and white. And it could mean brown, it could mean yellow, it could mean greenish. Different things for that. So the Zohar does not at all mean that the esrog is supposed to be green. And in fact, it's a shaila if the esrog is green. We paskin that if, as long as the esrog is in the process of turning yellow, it's okay. It doesn't actually have to be completely yellow. Others don't like that. They say that it's an incorrect color for an esrog to be green, and if the esrog isn't, especially if it's dark green, is even more of a problem, but especially if an esrog is, but they say that really it should be yellow. And everybody agrees that the biggest hiddur, the most beautiful esrog, is one that's completely yellow. So again, if you have one that's green, especially a light green, and it's clearly starting to turn yellow, so Mikra, then that would be okay, but it would be preferable to get an esrog that's mamish, completely yellow. In some varieties of the breeds of esrog that we mentioned 2 weeks ago, sometimes it's hard to get completely yellow ones. Okay, that's lulav. The lulav. So what about the lulav? What passes the lulav? So all the minim, if it's dried out, it's no good.
Last year's lulav won't do.
That's not true, necessarily.
The spine can't be split.
The spine can't be split. That's true. But we're machmir that... Okay, the Mishnah says that nechleka hatiomes is pasul. That if the double leaf is split, then it's no good. So what's a double leaf? What's a double leaf? So according to most Rishonim, actually, all the leaves of the lulav are double leaves. If you look at it, that's how it's comprised.
Yeah.
It's comprised of leaves that the leaves of the lulav are double. They're folded, they're like a V shape. They're folded like that. Uh-huh. So when the Mishnah says that it's pasul if the tiomes, the dual leaf, is split, it means if most of the leaves in the lulav are split.
Most.
So that you never find. Never find such a thing. That would be extremely rare to find such a thing. But we're machmer, based on other Rishonim, that it's talking about the main leaf. What's the main leaf? The center leaf of the lulav. That's why when everybody goes shopping for a lulav, immediately the first thing you do is you take the lulav, you pull it, you lower it to your eye level to the top of the lulav, and you start spreading the leaves with your fingers to try to, you take one leaf off each side until eventually you get an even number of leaves down on each side until eventually you're just looking at the middle leaf. So there are different shitas about how much the middle leaf has to be split in order to be considered puzzle. Some say it has to be split all the way down to the spine, which is also rare. Some say most of the way to the spine. Some say a tefach. And of course, we can't leave well enough alone. We always have to have chumras with lulavim. And you have some shitas that say, no, split is split. That if it's even, it should be that if it's even the split, the tiniest amount, then it's no good. So that's not maker adin. We don't really paskin like that. But if at all possible, if you can leaf through a few lulavim and you can find one, you find one that's completely closed all the way to the top. That is the preferable type of lulav. But again, if it's a little split, so it's not by any means. The end of the world. You have a certain type of a lulav, which is called a deri lulav, which is a deri lulav. There's a particularly high quality of lulav that's very green and lush. That's also a thing that people are, even though it's not really considered dry, if it's just a little, yellowish instead of a lush green, people want it to be really not dry, so they try to get a lush green lulav all the way to the top. Again, these are all, strictly speaking, really chumris. But the deri lulavim cost much more. They don't come in these, sets. When you buy the esrog, you get a lulav for free. You have to pay good money for them. But a lot of times people buy the deri lulav because it'll save you, if you really want a fine lulav, so it will save you the effort of leafing through a ton of lulavim to get to the one you want. But it is important that you have to check the lulav to make sure that it's not split more than necessary. There is another type of problem, which is called when it's it looks like a hemnik. What's a hemnik? A hemnik is a tool that looks like a V. So the simple understanding is when the lulav is split in half so that it looks like a V, it's a problem. But we try to be machmir that even if you allow a split tiomes, the middle leaf, it shouldn't be split in a manner that at least recognizably to the naked eye without looking at it close, that the tips are obviously pointing away from each other at all, that we consider that potentially a hemlig. That's another thing to look for with lulav, that even if it is a little split, the split shouldn't look like that. You should make sure the lulav is straight, and you can look at, hold it out in front of you. That if it's a little bent, it's okay, but it should be as straight as possible. If it's very bent, it could be a problem. Again, if the leaves are starting to hang downwards instead of being flush with the stem, that could be a problem, but with the spine. But it's important if you're going chopping for yourself, you have to learn a little bit what to look for. If you really don't know what you're looking at, then you're not gonna be able to find one. You might not be yotze, and you might not get as good one for your money, because you'll just take whatever the first one comes, as opposed to even looking through a few with a little effort. So what about the arava and the hadas? So the arava, if most of the leaves are gone, then that's a problem. That has to be most of the leaves. And the hadas, again, most of the leaves have to be there, and they have to be mishu loshim. They can't be, the wood cannot be chopped off. It has to be on the top. And that's also in distinction with the arava that you take on the last day of Sukkot, on Hoshana Rabbah, which does not have these requirements, and even one leaf is sufficient. So, one stick and one. We usually take a bigger bundle because it's prettier, but because I'll be Kabbalah, you're supposed to take more. But technically speaking, even one arava stick and with one leaf would be good for Hoshana Rabbah. So we're out of time for today. So we'll try to finish this up quickly next time, and then we can progress to the next mitzvah.